Hi, everyone. My name's Jason. I'm an alcoholic. I met Aaron in person last night at dinner. We had all-you-can-eat buffet. He had an impressive performance with how much you put down for a skinny guy compared to me. Anyway, he has a real gift of... ever since I got sober, I magically turned into an introvert. Without the alcohol to lubricate things, I find public speaking exhilarating, for example. anyway, Aaron had something that I really love in people who are sober for a while. He put me right at ease and cracked me up, too, and my girlfriend, too. We had a really nice time, and I thought I'd had never heard of Aaron before or anything. And then last night I started listening to his story. I stalked him on YouTube. You'll probably find a lot of our speakers on YouTube. And realized he's the person who made me cry while I was walking my dog. About a year ago, I had listened. My sponsor had passed on a speaker tape from him, and I had listened to it. Anyway, I think you're in for a treat tonight. Well, this afternoon. He asked me to read a passage, and this is from the family afterward. Cling to the thought that in God's hand, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Thanks.
My name's Aaron. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here today. Grateful to be sober. Thank you, Jason. And thank you for dressing up. Honestly, that's what I would rather be wearing up here. You know, I come from a town of 10,000, Malala, and I grew up in a much smaller town than that. I'll talk a little bit about it. I want to thank Mike for inviting me up here. The committee, anybody that's on the committee, please raise your hand at this time or stand up. Thank you, guys. A lot of work goes into this stuff, you know, and last night we had a great dinner, and the committee showed up. You know, sometimes you'll get a couple, three people, the whole committee showed up, and it was just a lot of fun. And so I'll tell you a little bit. My sobriety date is January 24, 2007. I have a home group, the Canby Saturday Breakfast Meeting. We meet at 9 a.m. at Jarbo's. In Canby, Oregon. Obviously, they do the meeting when I'm not there because I'm here today. I'm a GSR at that group, so I hold an active service position. I hold an active vote in that group. But if I'm not there, you would have found me Thursday night, Freedom in the Steps. It's kind of like a secondary home group to me. And what I do in there, that's 6:30. We meet at the Canby Four Square Church. So if you're ever in town, either one of those meetings, I'd love you to drop by. If I'm not at the breakfast meeting, ask somebody, they will buy you breakfast from me. I'll usually have to pay them back because they're all cheap. I'm not. But I would love to invite you to breakfast. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. That's very important. And I've worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I continue to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'd like to thank our speakers this morning to kick us off. They really kicked us off. Yeah. It was really nice to hear an Al-Anon drop the F-bomb from the podium twice. I was thoroughly impressed by that. I was thoroughly impressed. You know, see, we did that. So, sometimes you have to talk about tell the story in the language in which it was lived. So, she did a great job, and seeing her dad up here introduce her was just, that was heartwarming. That was the stuff, man. And so, let's see, a little about my story, you know, and I always say I still get a little nervous up here, you know, and a long time ago I asked this guy and this old boxer from up in Canada, I said, how long you been speaking? And he says, I've been speaking about 30 years. I said, do you still get nervous? And he said, I had a guy tell me one time, he goes, I get nervous every time. He goes, I had a guy tell me one time years ago, that if you don't get a little bit nervous, you got nothing to say because it's all coming from here and not here, right? So I hope today I give you a message of the heart. I hope there's somebody here that needs to hear what I have to say, right? I believe in the fifth tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. That's really the only thing that I'm doing here today, you know, and I believe in that. So I hope you hear something or feel something from one of the speakers that keeps you coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my experience. So I grew up in a tiny little town, Eddyville, Oregon. You have much more country than where you're at, Jason. I graduated 19 kids in my class, pretty much the same 19 that I started school with. And a little logging community, a little millworking community way out in the middle of nowhere. If you haven't heard of it, nobody in Oregon has heard of it either. I always say it's a blue-collar town where men are men and so are the women, right? That's kind of where I grew up. So, that's the way it was, you know. It was a hard-working town. And my parents, both functioning alcoholics, they reforestation company, my dad planted trees, slash, all that stuff. And alcohol was very prevalent. My grandpa was head of sales for Olympia Brewing Company back when Olympia was the big, yeah, a lot of Olympia drinkers in here, I'm sure. And head of sales, he was the guy that would bounce through towns, you know, Oregon and Washington, and he'd buy the whole, you know, the whole bar around, and they called him Red Ole. His name was John, but they'd call him red hair, and they called him Red Ole. And everybody knew my grandpa, you know, so we had Olympia everything. Legend is Olympia was the first word I ever spelled. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it probably is. So that's it. There was a lot of extracurricular activities going on with tree planters, all that stuff. A lot of that's legal now. I won't get into that, but it was just kind of an outlaw, countercultural lifestyle. You know, that's how I grew up, out in the middle of nowhere. And alcohol was always a constant. You know, there was always a constant. Those were the days where I remember my dad getting pulled over. The cops would just tell him to go home. I remember getting pulled over the second time in a night, and finally they take his beer and then tell him to go home. And those were kind of the days, right? And so I had my first drink of alcohol. I was 4 or 5 years old at a company party of my dad's. We used to have these big underground pig bakes and, you know, just country stuff. And it was whiskey. And I remember it. And I'm not saying I started drinking at 4 or 5 years old, but that's how accessible it was. You know, I remember they'd pass around the bottle, and one of his friends thought it was funny to hand me a little, you know, a jug of whiskey and watch the kid, you know, almost vomit on himself, whatever. But I didn't start drinking on a regular basis until I was about 15 years old, you know, and I think our speaker said this morning, you know, she was a late starter, about 14. I started about regular basis about 15, and I drank alcoholically from the time that I started, you know. I liked drinking alcoholically from the time that I started, right? The doctor's opinion says I drank mostly for the effect produced by alcohol. That was me. I absolutely loved it. I'm not that guy that's going to stand up here and say I drank because I didn't feel like I fit in or this or that. I drank because it unleashed some sort of demons, I like to say, and it you know, I exploded into, I loved it, right? And it created chaos and a lot of fun in my life. The thing is, I look back on it, and I don't know. The big book talks about, you know, if there's ever a point with a hard drinker or a problem drinker that something goes wrong in his life, you know, his wife threatens to leave him or he gets a DUI, there's a point in your time where you can go, okay, there's the consequence. I'm going to put the plug in the jug, right? If there ever was a point like that in my life, I blew right past it, right? And that's a reflection. You know, I just blew past it. Consequences became no part of my vocabulary. I just said, you know, I had a good time, and I liked all the fighting and the bonfires and the four-wheeling, everything that went behind, you know, living in the country. And graduated when I was 17 years old. Went right into the logging business, and down in Oregon, you know, it's, you know, the 200-foot trees. I know a lot of guys that have been killed and maimed logging, and it was dangerous work. So if you do that at 17, 18 years old, the thing is, after work, we drank all around the crew cab. You know, the bosses buy beer for, because if you're old enough to go out and do that, you're old enough to drink, right? And the thing is, I drank, you know, the doctor's opinion, I always say, you know, people always talk about the first 164 pages of the big book. Read the first 164. The first 164. I always say read doctor to doctor, right? I always say the doctor's opinion through Dr. Bob's nightmare, right? We skip our co-founder's story for some reason. The doctor's opinion tells me I have an allergy from alcohol, right? I have an illness of body and mind. And my mind, what it is, will always obsess. I'll always be thinking about drinking. If I'm not drinking, I think about drinking. When I'm drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. And the allergy is, once I take that first drink, no matter how long it's been, there's an allergy. And what is that allergy? It's an abnormal reaction. And the abnormal reaction for me, for us, is once I take that first drink, then I start craving. I can't get enough. And that's the way it was all through my drinking. And from the very beginning, I liked that. I thought it was part of it. I drank to oblivion. I enjoyed all of that, right? Towards the end, it wasn't like that. You know, the allergy was I just couldn't stop. So, but, you know, to go back, you know, 17, 18 years old, I get my first DUI, 18 years old. I moved over to the big city of Philomath. It had about 4,000 people in it. They had police officers, right? Right off the bat, I start getting in trouble with the law. It doesn't make me an alcoholic. It makes me a guy that makes very bad decisions. I make bad decisions sober, right? But I always say, you know, like Big Book talks about, we made a decision, the third step, and followed it through with vigorous action. I'm like, I always say, I made a lot of bad decisions, followed through with vigorous action. That was just my life. So I end up in Alcoholics Anonymous the first time I was 18 years old, and I walked in, and I had a DUI, so I had the court slip, so I'm trying to follow through. And it was a room, about 10 people. It was a Thursday night in Philomath, you know, so I walk in there. The average age was hospice, you know, everybody was you know, I was 18 years old. That's what it looked like to me. That's what I was visualizing. I'm like, oh, God, I can't relate to this. And I'm like, I just remember the topic was serenity, right? I had no idea what they were talking about. Serenity. But it stuck with me all these years. And it went around, and this lady said she was old. She was about 40, probably 45. And I was like, it went, and it got to her, and she said, my idea of serenity is I just stay home on a Friday night, and I pet my cat. And I'm like, whoa, this is not for me. And then years later, I'm thinking, maybe she was trying to hit on me. I was 18, and it went right over my head, right? Maybe it was attraction rather than promotion. I just missed the whole thing, right? But here I am. I'm oblivious to what's going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. But honestly, it was like that just... You know, it just wasn't for me at that time. I was still having a good time. And when you're still having a good time like that, there's just no stopping an alcoholic that's still in his cups, that is still working for, right? And it worked for me. And so what I learned is real quick, and I don't suggest doing this if you're new, that I could sign my own slips. I didn't even bother having my friend sign. I just started signing my own slip. The club is AA, right? They didn't check, and then I would just sign the date. And I'd turn those in, and, you know, it's taken me forever. It took me 13 months to get through an 18-week program, outpatient, you know, more MIPs and stuff by the time I got out of there. By the time I was getting out, I would not quit drinking, you know. And, I mean, there was part of it is I could not because I did want to continue, you know, complete this program. But they put me on Anabuse by the time I was out of there. I don't even know if it's legal to still do it anymore. But for those of you that don't know that might be younger, basically it's court-appointed poison that they give you. So you go in, I mean, that's what it is. You go into the pharmacy and they give you a little shot. And you sign off on the slip and you take a shot. And they say, now, if you drink on this, it causes serious illness or it could kill you. And I'm like, all right, I'll give it a shot. You know, I'm a real alcoholic, so that's the thing. So I drink on it, and I'm like, I'd feel my blood pressure go up, just rise. And anybody, I'm sure there's always somebody in here that has drank on Anabuse. My blood pressure would raise, and I would turn bright, like Fred's shirt there, bright red, and to the point where I'd be driving through town without a license, of course, and my buddy would be like, what was wrong with you yesterday when I saw you drink? I'm like, well, I was just trying a little controlled drinking on the Anabuse, you know, it seems like it's going okay, I'm not getting violently ill, but that was the insanity of it. I just did that kind of stuff over and over, and my drinking never slowed down, you know, and I was married and divorced by the age of 20. I had a son by the age of 20. My son or my wife thought, you know, I was going to get married and settle down and, you know, quit drinking. That's what you did. And it just, yeah, it just wasn't happening. And, my drinking led to the end of that relationship. And, you know, I'm not proud of this, but I just turned my back on my family. And selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our problem. And I was self-will run riot 100%. You were not going to, the pedal to the metal, you know, I'm not going to stop my partying. And I got into some other stuff, some outside issues. I call them drugs, right? You know, and I always say, you know, there was the beginning, like it was said this morning, alcohol was my first demon. Alcohol was my last demon. And absolutely alcoholic. In between, there's all sorts of bad decisions, right? And that was one of them. But that was just something I found. I was exhausted every weekend from logging, and somebody gave me something. And the magic was I was wide awake drunk. I loved the feeling being in. I was like, oh, this is magic, right? So I could get through the weekend. And that just accelerated my alcoholism to a whole other level. And I started getting into more and more trouble with the law, a lot of county jail time, a lot of treatment centers. By the age of 24, I had a suspended sentence for 19 to 24 months for prison, and that's just where it took me. I was just getting at, and so I knew if I got in any more trouble, I did 6 months in jail, and then I got out, and I did 56 days in treatment. I got out of there. I had the suspended sentence. I get out of there, and part of me says, I'm not going to drink again. I'm going to come back for Tim's graduation next week. You know, we're going to get together, and I build this camaraderie in treatment like a lot of us do. You give me a lie detector test. When I leave there, all of that stuff's going to happen. Within 24 hours of me getting out there, I'm seeing the girl I'm not supposed to be seeing. I'm doing the things I'm not supposed to be doing, and I'm drinking the things that I'm not supposed to be drinking. And I'm right in the same rotation, right? It's unstoppable. So that lasted 3 months without me getting in trouble again. I find myself back in court in front of the judge, and I knew I was going to receive that prison sentence. At that time, my dad had asked, you know, can I come down and say something to my son's behalf, to my attorney? My attorney was, you know, happy to have anybody come down and speak on my behalf at that point. And so it came that time. My dad will say that was the most heartbreaking moment he's had as a father, to see, you know, I was a kid. I graduated from high school. I played sports. I grew up with a small town where we were all together. All the kids spent their time together, all the family. You know, I was that kid. We were just a normal kid. And he said to watch your son come in shackled and chained to four or five other guys into the courtroom was heartbreaking, right? And so he got his chance to get up before the judge, and what he said, this is to speak on my behalf. He said, that's my son. And he said, he's becoming institutionalized, and he's become a threat to himself, and he's become a threat to society. So I suggest you give him the maximum amount of time that you can. Nobody was laughing at that time, you know, like, I wasn't laughing, my attorney was not laughing, you know, it's like, but that's what they did, you know, and I deserved it, you know, I was a danger, you know, without a doubt, you know, I had a police officer tell my girlfriend one time, this is the way this guy will always be, you know, I reflect on that, this is the way he will always be, he's never going to change, and that's what kind of, that's the view of what law enforcement had on me, and that's why Alcoholics Anonymous is such a miracle, right? You know, we change lives, we create different lives, we come in and we're just different people, you know, and so, yeah, so I went through all that. I moved up to, I got out of prison, moved up to Portland to get away from the drugs and alcohol with my with my aunt, and went through that. I started school. I was going to go to college to become a police officer because I was delusional, right? Oh, I know a lot about the law, right? And so, but yeah, after about 3 hours, about three years, I was supposed to be there for 3 months. I love my aunt. I just saw her the other day. She's like a second mom. My uncle was like a local legend musician, so it wasn't like they were Ozzy and Harriet or anything. You know, I'd go out to the club, but it was, I'd spent all that time through treatment, through prison and all that, and I hadn't drank. I got out, I was doing treatment, and it was just that one drink. I was working for my aunt, I go to a company party, and I think, oh, microbrews, right? I was weaned on Olympia and hams. Microbrews has got to be different, and You know, it wasn't, you know, anything I drink, I ingest, I need more automatically. And so that was the deal. And after about 3 years, she said, you know, Aaron, we've done about all we can do for you, you know, and you're going to have to move on. So I had to go out and get a job. I start filing all these applications, and they told me in boot camp that I went through a prison boot camp, and they said, just be truthful on the application. And when you get in for the interview, just tell them what happened. And I'm like, okay. So I'm following through, and I'm marking yes on a criminal background. Yes, yes, yes. And I'm not getting any calls. So I'm like, this isn't working quite like it. And so I had a buddy of mine that I used to run around with way back in the day. He'd kind of straightened out and got a good union job. He said, just mark, come out here, fill out the application, mark no on the application. And he goes, I think they're pretty lenient on the background checks. And sure enough, I marked no on the application, and I got in, and I'd cleaned up a little bit and got through the UA and got a good job, you know, and with a lie on the application. And so I start working at this place. I work swing shift, 3 bars across the street. We get out at 12:30 in the morning. The writing's on the wall. I'm not going to get into the whole thing, but, you know, I go over there, some guys after work after a couple weeks, and, you know, most of them, 90% of the people out there, can go out and have a couple beers, get up with their kids in the morning, you know, take them to school, do whatever it is, go out and take care of their stuff during the day, and I can't. I go over there and I have one drink with them, and it turns into, you know, countless. I don't show up to work the next day. Maybe I show up to work the next day. You just never know. It's rolling the dice. What's going to happen with me in my life? When I was younger, I used to love that. You know, it'd be like, it's unpredictable, right? What's going to happen? It was great. Well, when you start trying to be an adult and your life is unpredictable and there's no accountability, it's not as cool. It's not as fun, right? And so I start going through that again, and you know, I'm an alcoholic, and by that point, I got written up a bunch of times on that job, and finally, I came to a point where I'm just like, I can't, yeah, I need some help. And it was literally, that was about 2001, and I went up to the general manager, and I'm hanging on to my job like I always was by a thread. I went up to the general manager, and I said, you know, I need some help, and I laid down everything every time I'd been written up, and I said, all of this stuff lies behind alcohol. And so they let me do an outpatient treatment program at that time. I started exploring some 12-step programs. A lot of it, you know, I clean up, I feel a little better, I start going to this program, tiptoeing around in the back. I always say I'd sit in the back on death row, and I just, you know, like, oh, it's going pretty good for you guys in here. This book, it was written in 1939, I'm not quite relating. I have this view of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's just kind of this boring program. I see it works for you, and I'm willing to hit the meetings, but still, I have that thing in my head that says, I can do this on my own, right? I can, and that was my biggest enemy is my own head. You know, I can do it on my own. I went to treatment. I know all the answers. I know what to do. I know what alcohol does. This time I'm going to do it. And I had a good run. You know, I put together about probably 4 or 5 months. A young lady by the name of Megan came out and worked. I worked at a distribution center. Huge distribution center. Her dad worked graveyard, so I never saw that crew. He had put out some sort of memo on that end. Nobody's to date my daughter. I didn't get the memo down on my end. His daughter was his pride and joy, and yeah. So right off the bat, he does a little investigation on my past, and I'm public enemy number one. I would pass that crew on the way, but I'm sober, right? And I'd gone out with her, and she fell in love with me when I was sober. You know, we started dating on a regular basis. Her dad hated me right off the bat. He wouldn't have me over the house. And, but I'm a sober individual, right? And that's who she connects with. And I was honest with her. I really wanted this sobriety. And I wasn't doing anything to maintain it, but in my head, I thought I had it under control. But there's that lurking notion, right? And I sat her down one night, and I said, if we continue with this relationship, there's something that you got to know about me. And first time I'd ever been honest with somebody in my life, I said, yeah, I have a serious drinking problem. And if I ever drink and we're together and if we're to move on with this, I just want you to leave me. And I meant it. She was a good person, good human being, wasn't a drinker, wasn't anything else, just a genuine person. And I didn't want to drag somebody else through the mud. You know, I'd done that in the past, and I 100% meant it, you know, and I thought in my heart, I'm like, this is it, you know, I'm not going to drink, but I better put out the warning, right? And she said, okay, you know, but she didn't understand, like the alcoholic understands, you know, Dick understands, he's nodding right along, he gets this story, unfortunately, I can relate to this guy, we progressed with this relationship. It took about 6 or 7 months before her dad would meet me, and finally, you know, her mom said, you know what, Martin, you're going to lose this battle, and you better just meet this guy. And so he finally brought me over to the house, and he literally, that's his attire right there. He's the bib, he is the country guy, the shaved head, and we just sat there in silence through this long, awkward dinner. And then she said, hey, Dad, we're going to go to the movies, so if you want to talk to Aaron, it better be time. So it was a very, he said that was the only thing that I ever did right was showed up to that dinner. So I was summoned into the next room and sat in front of his gun cabinet. And he said, so we just sat there and go quiet for a little bit. He said, hey, you know, Aaron, he goes, these are the three things that I do not like about you. And it was all downhill after that. And then I don't remember a lot of it. It was a lot of white noise. And then it came around to, and that's my little girl out there. And if you ever do anything to hurt her, he goes, I have no problem going to prison for any one of my kids. And I'm like, you guys have fun at the movies now. And I was like, that was my introduction to Martin. And I knew he meant it. To this day, he'll tell you that he meant it, you know. So, but yeah, we ended up moving in together. And going through the thing, and without getting into the whole story, went out to a friend of mine from South Dakota. I went back there. I'd lived back there for a year or so with my mom when I was younger, and I had a buddy of mine. We always used to go drinking together, and they sat a beer down in front of me at the bar, and I wasn't going to. He's like, you don't have to drink. And I'm like, well, that's the only way I know how to fight you. That's how we grew up together, right? And they sat it down there. And I'm like, I'm not going to drink, you know, I don't, he's like, you don't have to drink about it. But the alcoholic, right, like I said, we have that obsession of the mind. As soon as you set it down there, I have no defense against that first drink. I have no higher power. I have no program. I have nobody in the program. You sit it there, and I don't care if it sits there for 12 seconds, 12 minutes, 12 hours. I'm going to think about it. I'm going to think about it. I'm going to think about it. And that's the obsession of the mind. And as soon as I drink that drink, the allergy kicks off. And I can't stop. And the next thing you know, I wake up in a blackout from it, you know, and I'm just like, have no idea where I am. I was at his house, no idea what else happened in that night. And what I did differently is I went back, when I flew back home, I told Megan the truth. And I remember her breaking down and crying. And it was like she knew something that I didn't know at that point. And what that did was, for an alcoholic, she didn't leave. Right? And for what that did for an alcoholic like me is it opened up the door where, all right, now I know, there, you know, now I've got a shot. And that's when I started drinking. I started lying about it. I started hiding around the house. Got another DUI. She got me connected with my son who I'd been estranged with. She was a good, solid person. And he was safe in the house with her. And she said, don't you want to have a relationship with your son? And I battled with that. You know, for several years, I wanted to be sober for that. And I just, the big book talks about one more attempt, one more failure. That's my mantra. One more attempt, I'd try to put it up, put the plug in the jug, and I'd fail. Go a couple weeks, and I'd fail. And thank God to the Al-Anons. She was the first person in my life that checked into Al-Anon and tried to get some support for the outside because she didn't understand what was going on, and I just couldn't stop. And like I said, she fell in love with me when I was sober, right? So it wasn't like she fell in love with this drunk guy. And she waited. Her parents never saw it. She saw something in me that they never saw. And she knew there was somebody good in there, right? Like a lot of us, right? Like most of us. 95% of us here. Besides Tim. Tim, so, no, but you know what I'm saying. And so she saw that. And she hung on to it. And she loved me. And for the next 5 years, you know, it was in and out of me, you know, falling on my face and getting back up. And we ended up getting married, and we bought a house out in Malala. Right, you know, she had a twin sister, and that was her dream, to have a house in the same community. And man, I wanted to stay sober for her. You know, like the big book says, you know, why can't we do it for her? You know, why couldn't we do this? And we can't answer that riddle, right? And so January 1st, 2007, we got married September 17th of 2006, and I'd put together about 22 or 23 days through the holidays. And January 1st, 2007, I sat down, and I'm like, this is going good, and I'm going to start out this year on the right track. And the very top of this paper, I wrote, do not drink. And under that, I wrote, be a better husband, be a better father, be a better brother, be a better son. And all I can sum that up into be a better man. And that's all I wanted to be. And I knew all of that fell on under do not drink. You know, those three words. And you give me a lie detector test one more time and I'm going to pass it. This is going to be the year. This is going to be the change. And 5 days later, I got a DUI with my 16-year-old son in the car. And, you know, he got hauled off in one police car. I got hauled off in the other and he was crying. And I'm 5 days earlier. Be a better father. Do not drink, right? And that's the insanity of this thing, is no matter how many times alcohol has burned me, no matter how many times I know it's going to be that next debacle, I do. The insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And really, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and knowing exactly what that result is going to be. Because every time, you know, I would just do it and... about 2 weeks later, you know, her incomprehensible demoralization, and her dad has to come down and pick me up from jail and with Megan and took me home, and I'm just like, this is never going to happen. You know, this is it. Till 2 weeks later, I'm driving home from work, and I got about a 12-mile drive home, and I make it almost all the way. I live out in the country, and there's 1 minute mark on the way back, about 2 miles from my house, and my car pulls in there automatically. I mean, and that's the way it is. It's like automatic. Like for me, you know, the treatment, the play the tape all the way through. My sponsor agrees with this. You know, I heard it from him. There's no playing the tape. I get drink in my head, and I drink. There's no, well, there's consequences this time. I have no defense. I have no choice. I have lost choice in that first drink, right? And the big book says that. I have lost the choice in drink. And I pull in there, and it says, you ask an alcoholic 100 times why he makes that next decision to drink, he's going to give you 100 different decisions. Once in a while, it's the right one. I don't know any more than you guys know. We can't answer the riddle, right? And it takes me out on another five-day bender. And Megan had taken the cars away from the house and went over to stay at her parents. And I was in and out of blackouts for 5 days. And I finally, at January 23rd, 2007, I just had what we call a moment of clarity. And moment of clarity while I was still drinking, you know, and I'm like, I just can't do this anymore. And I called her up on the phone, and for whatever reason, she agreed to come over. I said, I just need to talk to you. Please just come talk to me. And I sat her down, and I'm like, once again, 5 years earlier, I have a serious drinking problem. I just can't, but I can't do this anymore. I need help, you know, and she believed me. There was something different that night, and I passed out that night. And I woke up the next morning, and I live about 12 miles from the nearest noon meeting. You know, I work swing shift. I came to about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and I made it to that noon meeting. And I walked up the steps to this old Buena Vista house, this old beat-up house on the edge of a park, right? And I walked into that meeting, and my life changed forever. To this day, my life changed, right? And what had happened that morning is I walked in there, and thank God somebody was reading out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They weren't doing a check-in meeting about how your week's going or any of this. They read out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my friend always says, you know, if you look in the dictionary, you know, angels are messengers, right? And we can all carry a message in here. We're all messengers. Somebody, at some point, you're going to say something that sticks with somebody. And what that lady was that morning is she was a messenger. And what it was is she read, it was nothing she said. She read out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll paraphrase what she said. But what about the real alcoholic? Here's the guy that's been puzzling you. He builds his life up, and he tears it down within a senseless series of sprees. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He's more or less insanely drunk, antisocial drinker, and she was reading to me, man. And enough to where I grabbed that big book that day. I went and bought a big book. I bought two. I bought two big books because on the way home, I drive right by my wife's parents' house, and I make my first act of amends, and I pull in. I go into my mother-in-law. I said, I'm not going to do it. I'm sorry. I knew I was on a different, but I hand her a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't even cracked the cover on yet. And I'm like, if you read this, you'll probably figure out the reason I've been doing a lot of the stuff I've been doing all these years. And I was out of there. And what I did is I got home, and thank God nobody told me, you know, where the page was. And I start digging through that thing, right? And I start at the beginning. I start digging. And, you know, I go through the allergy and the obsession of the mind and all this stuff and hit the real alcoholic. And I'm finding myself on all of the pages, right, on this book that I've been dodging for years, on all of the pages. And why I say a lot of the stuff, Gary and I were talking this morning about the reflection. You know, we do these daily reflections. Gary was telling me how he does, you know, every couple of years he reflects back on what I was learning at these moments. And a lot of my stuff has been reflections through the years. And when Ron talks about angels and the messenger, you know, it took years before I heard that. And I reflected back on this lady that read out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wonder, who was that? And I don't remember anything else she said. I don't know if she ever came back to Alcoholics Anonymous the next day. I couldn't have pointed her out the next day. But she was a messenger that day, and that message was pure, straight Alcoholics Anonymous and changed my life, right? And that was an angel in my life. That was a messenger. And so I became connected, and I became, I started going to this group every day. I read through that, I get the message, and I start going to this group. And one of the best things was that in their reading, they'd say, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? They didn't say that once a coin, any of that. Anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? Every single day, I didn't sit on death row. I sat in the middle, and I said, my name's Aaron, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Aaron, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Aaron, I'm just like, God, this is the longest 30 days of my life. You know what I mean? And I'm like, it's all about me. I'm like, these guys got to think I'm drinking every night. And it's just coming back. And I'm like, but I got a phone number, right? One of the first guys that came across the room and gave me a phone number was a guy that had 21 or 22 years sober at the time. And I said, my name's Dennis. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Still doing the 12th step after all those years. Puts a phone number in my hand that I used, right? And so I'm connected, and I'm seeing people, and the puzzle's starting to go together, you know. And I always say I love places like this where the window, I mean, it's a beautiful day where the sunlight's coming through. And I remember when I got sober, it was January, right? And I'd been lived in this darkness in my room. You know, I'd been in the jail cells and the treatment centers and the prison. And I said towards the end, my brother always said, I drank to be free. And by drinking to be free, I created my own prison. And that's what it was like in those last days, right? And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, January in Oregon, you don't see a lot of those bright, sunny days, right? But they had the curtains drawn just like this, and it was like the first time that I'd seen the sunlight in years, right? And that was me coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. There was that sunlight of the spirit right in here, and it was attractive to me. What you guys shared pulled me in, and I started digging through the meeting schedule. And I found the Canby Saturday breakfast meeting, my home group to this day. And my thoughts were, all these people can afford breakfast, so they're probably doing better than I am. And that was literally my reasoning behind it. And I went in there, and I got there early, and there was a guy by the name of Steve Little. I was a half hour early, and I got in there, and there was this couple old guys in there. Steve Little was one of the guys from the noon meeting. And Steve's saying, without getting into the whole story, was he'd remember everybody's name. Now, this was before smartphones and all of that stuff. And somebody had done it for him. He'd been out for 4 or 5 months when he was early in sobriety and went back out. And he came through the door, and somebody said, hey, Steve, how are you doing? And a guy pulled him aside, and he said, Steve started crying. He said, how'd that make you feel? And he said, it made me feel good. And he said, I want you to do that for every guy that walks in the door. Remember their name. And Steve could do that. There was something about that connection. And so when I walk into that new meeting, there's Steve. Hey, Aaron, how's it going? And I become a part of that group, and I feel a part of. And the deal with that group, and it will be to this day, there's an electricity in there, right? Like you feel in here today, there's a buzz, there's an electricity that the people out there that don't understand Alcoholics Anonymous don't know about, and I didn't know about it. There's a buzz, there's electricity, there's laughter, and it drew me in, and I'm like, this isn't what I thought this was about, right? This is totally different. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was, it was a meeting you came into once a day, and everybody went their separate directions. I literally thought this, and nobody hung out outside of the rooms. It was just, you came in one noon meeting a day, or one 7 a.m. meeting, or a Friday night, and you went, yeah, congratulations, you got another day, and everything was pretty melancholy is the way I saw it. And I'm in here and these people are talking about, oh yeah, remember that diving trip we went on, or you know, that hiking, and we went over here in the sports, you know, all this stuff. I'm just hearing these stories of this fellowship that these people do outside of this, and they laugh and they're having an excitement, and that place was so loud. Still to this day, we finally got a bell where they ring the bell when they start the meeting. Is one guy, I'm so sick of you guys screaming at the top of your lungs to start this meeting. But that's the way it was. There was just this energy and vibrancy, and that was the attraction to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where it really pulled me in. And so I knew from that point on there was going to be my hurdle was going to be God. And, you know, I didn't grow up in a religious family. My dad had read the Bible cover to cover twice. He has a PhD, and, you know, it was a bunch of made-up stories. He was a born-again atheist, he'd like to say. But I was open to the concept. And that's, I read that big book, and I started reading the 12 and 12. Like they did, this is a reflection, back when they used to send it across the country, right? I wasn't reading it with somebody right off the bat. I had within my first 30 days, and I'm digging through that, and I'm finding all these answers, and I'm looking, and I'm like, okay, all I have to have is a willingness, right? God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him, and I'm like, okay, you know, these powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable. Man, I've been working on that for 20 years. It was obvious to everybody my life was unmanageable. I was the last one in on the secret, and then it's like, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. What does that mean? That means I come in here, and I have an open mind and an open heart, honest, open, and willing. The three indispensables in the spiritual experience in the back, where it's at the spiritual appendix, where it says the three indispensables are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I'm like, all I have to have is a little piece of open mind and an open heart. And I'm like, I think I can do that. And I'm my third weekend, February 17th. I heard a good friend of Ron Gary and Tim's by the name of Ron. He is celebrating 18 years of sobriety, and at our home group. And Ron, and I share this with his permission. Ron had been in a drunk driving crash back in the late 80s that killed a mother and her two children. And he had done 8 years in the penitentiary. And a guy by the name of Chicago, he shared a little bit about this, by the name of Chicago John, had brought a meeting in from the outside. And Chicago John had a manslaughter charge from back when he lived in Illinois. And he pulled Ron aside after this meeting. And Ron hadn't even claimed a sobriety date at this time. And so this is a guy that's doing H&I. And I always say, God bless anybody in here that's doing H&I. Hospitals and institutions, anybody that takes meetings into the jails and prisons. Because what Ron said that day, what this guy said was, Ron, you can't unring the bell, but you never have to ring it again. And he made a transformation from that day. Ron claimed a sobriety date of February 13th, 1989. And when Ron's sharing that story about that man that took the meeting inside the walls of the Oregon State Penitentiary in 1989, we always talk about where the message leaves the one and it reaches the many. When he shares that message to me, February 17th, 2007, outside the walls of the Oregon State Penitentiary, changes my life, right? Changes my life. That guy was a messenger. He was an angel for Ron. Ron, once again, was an angel for me. And blew the doors wide open, kicked it wide open to a power greater than myself. And what I did that day, I go back home and I find the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm on fire. I mean, I'm convinced this thing works. He had convinced me. And I find a simple prayer in there. Thy will, not mine, be done. And without getting into the whole thing of how I reflect on this is the third step, but I push, you know, it says the wording is optional, right? Sometimes we take it with somebody. And at this point on my reflection, I've gone back through this with a sponsor, I've gone back through it with several people. But at that point, when I read that prayer and I pushed all my chips into the middle, man, and I hit my knees because I heard in here that the prayers work better when you hit your knees, right? I'm listening to everything you say. And I hit my knees that day, and I said, thy will, not mine, be done. And I do that for the next several days. And that was February 17th. I do that for the next several nights. Thy will, every night I go to sleep, thy will, not mine, be done. Thy will, not mine, be done. And I feel this strength, and I'm getting stronger, and I'm excited, right? And going to that noon meeting every day. I'm still, my name is Aaron, I'm an alcoholic. And so I work swing shift, 4 to 12:30, to midnight on January 23rd, or February 22nd, rolling into the 23rd, pull that coin out of my pocket, and I get the 30 days. And I'm in the warehouse, I'm clinging onto this 24-hour coin, the heavy metal one, nothing against the plastic, but the breakfast meeting would give you those heavy metal coin, and I'm holding on to it, and I'm alive, right? I'm like, I made it. You know, it's past midnight. I'm going to go to that noon meeting the next day, and I found this quiet spot. I work in a warehouse. It's over 1 million square feet. I find this little pocket, and I just think. And what I'm doing now on a reflection is I'm meditating, right? I'm thinking about the 24 hours ahead, what God has in store for me, how much different my life has been. And I don't care how long you've been in here. If you plug into that higher power, as soon as you do, as soon as you can, your life can change, right? And that was my deal. I was a guy that obsessed. I drank no matter what, right? 30 days into this thing, I hit a connection. I heard the right thing. I had an open mind and an open heart. And things are going good for me, right? And I can't deny that. And so I get home at about 2 in the morning. And I walk through my bedroom door. And I find my wife, Megan, and she's not moving. And she's not breathing. And I call 911, never had to call 911 in my life. And they tell me how to do CPR and pull her out of the bed, and I start doing CPR, and I'm just telling them, hurry. I live in a small town, and I know it's not taking the paramedic. It feels like hours before they, and I'm just saying, please hurry, please hurry. And they said, is there anybody we can call? I said, call her dad, back when we memorized numbers. And I said, here's his number. And the paramedics got there, and they went back into the bedroom for just a couple minutes. And they came out, and they said, sir, can we speak to you in the other room? And I knew right then she was gone. And Martin came through. He lived about six miles away, and he drove up. And she walked through the door, and I said, Martin, she didn't make it. And he brushed past me like he just couldn't hear me, and the paramedics grabbed him in the kitchen before he could go in the bedroom. And they didn't want him to see his daughter. Like, I mean, he was rushing in there, and I saw this big man just collapse. And I heard the sound of a father's heartbreak, and he just let out this sound that I never want to hear again. And if you've heard it, you know what I'm talking about. And he just collapsed. And from there, we had to go tell her twin sister and go tell her mom and all this. And we're in shock the next day, right? She was 24 years old. Healthy, except she had epileptic seizures and only had about 6 in her whole life. And the doctor said, don't worry about them. Just give her medication, bring her back, and get her stabilized the next day. They're not life-threatening. No, they were wrong. And she passed away in her sleep, 24 years old. And so the next day, we're all in shock. And I don't make it to that noon meeting. But that night, and this is another reflection thing, and I used to say, you know, and I know what happened is I pulled out that coin, and I remember that night, and I was thinking about things. And I'm like, did I believe what I did 24 hours ago, right? I knew that Megan believed what was going on. I knew there was a shift. I knew I'd plugged into this. Was I fooling myself? Was I a boy whistling in the dark? Was I doing all that stuff, or did I believe it? And I had to, in my heart, go, I believed this. I believed it 100%. Now, reflecting back on that and the reading I do through the years, what was I doing in that moment? Either God is or he isn't. Either he's everything or he's nothing. And I hit my knees, and I will, not mine, be done. And I pass out on the living room floor. I can't make it back to the bedroom. And her father, Martin, came over. And like I said, he didn't live next door. And he opened up the door about 8 in the morning. And that was a Saturday morning. And he said, this is the last thing I promised my daughter is to get you a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous this morning. You're going to get up and you're going to go. And he couldn't get that out. I mean, this is a broken man, a heartbroken man. And she'd called him the night before she passed away. And you talk about how God has a plan, right? And she said, Dad, I got to work overtime on Saturday. Can you get Aaron to this meeting? I'm not son-in-law of the year. You know, he could have very easily, you know, and he could have slept through it. You know, what got that man up out of bed that morning? What caused him to come over? What got him there on time? What caused him to remember, of all things, one promise? Father's love, man. And he came in and he got me to that meeting. And you guys all cried with him. We broke down and we sobbed and we couldn't get the words out. The only thing that Martin could say was, I'm just here to show support for my son-in-law. And my daughter died last night. I'm fulfilling one promise to her. There was a guy, Steve Little, the one that remembered my name. He stood up. He said, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. When one of us hurts, we all hurt. And man, you guys surrounded us. My buddy Gary, didn't know him from Adam at that time. He was running the meeting. He says, is there anybody here that has 30 days today? My name's Aaron. I'm an alcoholic. And he gives me a hug. What does he say, Fred? Keep coming back. And that was the deal, man. And I stayed. Those guys stayed with me, surrounded me. They did Alcoholics Anonymous. When I think back to the men that stayed with me that day and stayed for an hour and a half with me and my father-in-law, not just me, they saw a family that was suffering, right? And they stayed with me and they gave us numbers. There was a guy by the name of Phil that's still part of my home group. He had a daughter named Megan that had passed away. So you think of the connections and the you know, those coincidences that aren't coincidences. You know, the odds of this man that was sitting in that meeting that also had a daughter that had passed away by the name of Megan. And I think back at those guys, and all of them have either died sober or they're still sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason behind that, because they worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were working the 12 steps. They were reaching. They were taking their time. They put whatever else was going on in their day on the back burner to help two men that were struggling and suffering, man. And they saved our lives. You know, there was something about that meeting, you know, that drew me in. That initial attraction was part of these guys didn't just talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. They were living Alcoholics Anonymous. When they talked about the steps, they made the steps attractive because when I stepped out on the back porch with them, they talked about the same thing, but they talked about their families. They talked about their jobs. They talked about what was going on in their lives, and it matched up, man. It matched up. It wasn't a different message, right? They acted the same out there as they were in here, and that's what drew me in, and that's what those men were doing. And, you know, from there... We had to plan a memorial within a week for somebody that passed suddenly. You know, that's tough to do. But we put together some beautiful slideshows. And, you know, Megan made the mistake of letting me pick out the music for our wedding. I'm a huge music fan. And I had picked Walk the Line by Johnny Cash. And it was a slowed down, a beautiful Johnny Cash. It was the most beautiful version he'd ever heard. And if you've never heard it, it was by Travis Tritt. And it was a slowed down version. And when I got up there, the only thing I could say, I was so messed up. My uncle was there, the guitar guy, and he sat up there on the church stage, just him and a guitar, and I said, this is the first and last song I ever danced to with my wife to, and it's a promise, and it's a dedication, and you guys know the story of Walk the Line. Why that was ever chosen, I don't know. A promise and a dedication, and in my heart, that meant I'm not gonna be the man that I was. I'm gonna keep doing this thing for Megan, and you guys have helped me do that for the last 19 years, because I cannot do it without your help, right? And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. So he played that song, man, and, you know, that started my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, most of that, you know, my story there is a lot of what happened, man. And if you're new here, all of that stuff can happen for you. Maybe not in such a dramatic fashion. We all have stories, right? But, man, there was a power in those rooms, and you guys saved our lives. And Martin, you know, who isn't a fan of me, he took me to that first meeting. He took me to that Saturday meeting for the next 3 years. That man that hated me, right? And he loves to tell people, doesn't he, Tim, that he hated my guts, right? He's like, yeah, I hated Aaron. 8 years sober, that man has never missed this year because he had a friend that was going through some traumatic stuff. But for 18 years, he never missed a meeting when I celebrate my birthday, and he's sitting there next to me. And you guys would let him share. Thank God for the open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and those guys that saw this was a man that was hurting. This was part of a family. And he would say, when he'd share, he'd say, my name's Martin. I'm an honorary alcoholic. Everybody kind of chuckle at first. And about 2 years into the, I was on, coming into my second year, and I was sharing with my mom. I said, she said, does Martin ever share at those meetings? And I said, yeah. I said, he says he's the, and as soon as I started saying it, you ever feel like you just get punched in the heart by God? And I was like, have you ever had those tears where just I started just sobbing? And that whole time he'd been saying what? He'd be honored to be one of us. And man, you guys helped us. You connected us. You repaired that family. I've filled in at a Christmas table, Thanksgiving table for the last 19 years with that family. That man will tell you I'm his son. You know, that's Alcoholics Anonymous, man. That was a man that hated me, right? And that family bent over backwards to help me out through my sobriety. Real quick, because I'm running out of time, I'll tell you about my job. It was 10 years. I'd been sober about 2.5 years, and I'd made Employee of the Year out of 300 guys. They promoted me to foreman. You know, there's a whole story behind that with just unreal stuff. And then they terminated my employment at 10 years for falsifying my employment application. That's called the wreckage of our past, right? And but I went on from there. I got hired by an old boss that was like, didn't want to hire me. And Martin vouched for me. He said, he's a different man than that used to work for you. And he goes, I'll give him 2 weeks. And I worked there for 15 years and worked my way up into management. And that place just shut down. And I just went back to school this last year, and I'm hoping to go into juvenile corrections. And I just wrapped up. So it's like, God has a plan, man. God has a plan, and I can't doubt any part of that. You know, my brother called me August 1st, 2010. He needed to get his wife to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because she was getting into all his booze and eating his pills. And I'm like, oh, God, we got to get you, got to get her to a meeting. She's killing your stash. You know what I mean? Like, but I knew my brother, he's my only blood brother. He didn't get to make as many bad decisions as I did, but we were definitely both alcoholics, right? So there was a meeting right down the street, and I think Tim was at one of my brother's first meetings. It was a 12 and 12 club, old school Alcoholics Anonymous, and they handed my brother, of all people, how it works to read. And he makes it halfway through that and breaks down in tears, and something hits him in the heart, right? And he knows he's where he belongs. And they've both been sober. This rarely happens since August 1st, 2010. And that applause is for you guys, man. And I was one of those guys, I got sober and I never pushed it down there. It was a try. I'm like, my brother saw what it did in my life, and he knew where the phone was, what to do when the time came for his wife to get sober. And they're not just sober. A lot of people get sober, get their life, they're active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I talk to my brother when we get on the phone. I can't get off in less than an hour, right? And but we talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, what it's done for us and what it's done for our lives, and it's just life changing. You know, I'll just get in, you know, made amends with my son. I've been there for the birth of my two grandchildren. You know, 18 years sober. I stood on the top of Mount Hood, you know, those things that we always see. God, I wonder what it'd be like to do that. 11,300 feet in the air, you know, I think about the trudge, right? The trudge of the road of happy destiny. And I get to the top of that thing, man, and I think about it. And it's a climb. And I'm up there, and we climbed up on a full moon. We got there, and it's a sunrise on the top of this mountain, 11,300 feet in the air, man. You can see out to the desert, and you can see the ocean, and you can't tell where the land ends and the sky begins, man. And I take a pocket full of Megan's ashes, and I grab a handful of snow, and I throw them to the wind, man. As close to heaven as I could get. And I thank God, and I thank you guys for getting me there, man, to the top. And it's just moments like that, man. I just, the volcano, you just can't make this stuff up, man. And the places I've been and the things I've got to see and hang my feet over the edge of the Grand Canyon, still make bad decisions, you know. But I'm like, I get to see this stuff. I get to be a part of it. You know, I have a great family of friends, and we've got to do that stuff, the travel in the world and going all over and doing the thing. And it's just like, what a beautiful life. But I'll get to the point when my mom had MS, my whole time growing up. And for the last several years of her life, she lived in a care facility right down the road, about a mile from me. And my mom would say, you know, Aaron, when you were in prison, I was her baby boy. You know, we grew up out in the hill. My mom used to have to pack water and chop wood. My dad was a reforestation contractor. He was out of town camping with his crew a lot of the time. My mom worked. She packed wood and carried water. And she busted her butt for her kids. And she said, well, Aaron, when you were in prison, man, you know, I'd cry the blue out of my eyes. She was always pretty dramatic, you know. I'd cry the blue out of my eyes. But towards the end, it was right during COVID, you know, it was, she started getting real sick. And I'd go over and visit her. And I could just sit outside the window. And she got progressively sick. And they said, sometimes just MS just hits. You know, she was always very good with her mind and spirits. Got to a point where she couldn't walk, so she couldn't leave the facility. But man, I'd make my mom, one of the biggest gifts, one of my biggest amends, is I could go in there and I could make my mom laugh. You know, and she would laugh with her whole body. She'd make me laugh. And, you know, that's, and so they got to a point where they said, well, if she gets put on hospice, you can make it into the facility. So I'd get to go in there and I'd spend time with my mom. And I would talk to her, and we listened to old Merle Haggard and Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson and listen to this stuff. And I'd read to her just so my mom could hear my voice. And to the day she died, we didn't communicate for about the last 2 weeks. But I'd come in and I'd say, hey, Mom, it's Aaron. She wouldn't open her eyes, but my mom had a smile that would light up this room to the day she died. And I would read out of this book, and I always say, you know, the big book talks about, you know, we enlarge our spiritual program. You know, we see where religious people are right. We make use of what they have to offer. And so there's been a lot of, I always ask people, what are you reading? And I'm reading this book, and it's a series of short essays. And I'd been bouncing around in this book. And this is from a guy I call a spiritual giant out of Lubbock, Texas. And this was the last thing. It was like, I'm like, why is this? The title was a little weird. But this ended up being the last thing that I read my mom on the night she passed, and she just listened to me. And there's a reason. One, God has a plan, that this was the last thing I read her. And it's called God is a Four-Letter Word. And that's what kept me from reading it. But it's, it says, no matter what your religion, you likely have your own idea of what God is. Some think of God as that big guy in the sky who makes all the decisions for us. Some say God is a woman. Some say God is dead. Some say God never was. My view is simple. Believe that God is love, period. End of story. For love runs through everyone and everything. Every one of us loves the flowers, and the flowers love the rain. If you love the ocean, you know the ocean lives and loves to caress the shore. Love is a thing we all have in common. We ache for love. We hope for love. We love and like to be loved, and that's God. Take these words of wisdom with you everywhere you go. Tell all the religions of the world, and through them the truth shall flow. But God is love, and love is God. That's all you need to know. It goes on to say, the universe in which we're born is infinitely large, and each of us is so small. We search for meaning when the meaning is all around us. In every moment of our day, we search for you, Lord. We always have. We give you the form that we can understand. You've always been with me in all of your many forms. I started in a Methodist church, but found myself at ease with every religion I've tried to understand. I can't tell you now whether I'm a Baptist or a Buddhist. Considering my footwear, maybe I'm just a Buddhist, a boot-wearing man who believes we are put here for a reason and that by doing our best, we may find the light we seek. If not, our souls are eternal, and perhaps next time around we'll do better. Spoke to me in the church, and you spoke to me in the fields and the open pastures. You spoke to me in the songs of the mockingbirds and the blue jays who flew above us. Spoke to me through the rustle of the Texas wind and in the trees and through the thunder in the night. And when I paused to listen, you still speak to me. Spoke to me through the music and the guidance from my mother, who told me God always prevails because God, because good and goodness can never be defeated. I wrote a song for you once called In God's Eyes, but maybe I wrote all those songs for you, just as all those songs were gifts from you. You're with me at the birth of my children and the passing of my friends. You're with me when I gaze out at the blue bonnets of Texas. I feel you and I marvel and wonder at the brilliant rainbows of Maui, and when I sing to the little frontier chapel in Luck, and when I stop for reflection on a quiet weekday in the Methodist church where my sister and I first lifted our voices to the heavens. The beauty of this world and the people in it have always been with us. You give us the power to see and smell and touch it. We are born of love, and it is love that carries us through. And my mother knew that I loved her. And my brother was able to tell her, you know, your sons are safe right before she died because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's love. And I believe that there's a love that runs all through us. And like a father's love, there's somebody up here that loves us all. And that's God. Thank you.